Welcome to From the Booth, the podcast sponsored by the BYU International Cinema Program. I'm Chip Oskerson, co-director of international cinema, coming to you from Paris, France, joined today by fellow co-director Mark Yamada, who's in Provo. Good to be with you again, Mark.
Good to be here again.
Today we'll be discussing the films from the 6th to the 9th of October that showed at IC. They're all part of the Bridges and Walls series that were in commemoration of the 30th anniversary of the opening up of the Berlin Wall and is part of the Kennedy Center's series Bridges and Walls that they're running this semester. As always, as we discuss these films, we'll presume that you've seen them, so there won't be any spoiler alerts, but when we get to previewing the films for this coming week, we'll show greater restraint and suggest some key things to look for, but without giving away anything important to the unfolding of the plot. We provide time codes in the program notes if you need to skip forward in our discussions. Mark, let's start this week with Midnight Traveler. We had some special events around this documentary film that was a big hit at Sundance this last year.
Yeah, Emily Madavian, who is a writer, director, and editor of the film, came to BYU and led a really interesting Q&A after the film was screened at International Cinema. So really great discussion with her. I know that you met her at Sundance after the film, right?
That's right.
It seems like she has spoken on the film quite a bit at various venues and places and really had some interesting things to say. And I think went beyond just some of the basic questions that she usually gets about, you know, the family's welfare and how they're doing and the progress of them, you know, finding a home and getting citizenship. And really kind of went into some of the production elements, which were kind of interesting to me to hear about firsthand. And I think our students were really interested in as well about it. But really interesting discussion and something that I think will be available to hear on our website.
Yeah, we're going to try and get that question and answer up. It was fun to hear from her. For those of our listeners who haven't seen the film, it's about a family, this is a documentary, so true life, a family who is fleeing the Taliban in Afghanistan. They first go to Tajikistan, then back to Afghanistan when their visa runs up there. Then they go to Iran, then Turkey, Bulgaria, Serbia, Hungary, all trying to make it to Germany. And all of this is shot in the moment on cell phones. And so our guest, Emily Madavian, played a special role in that she was the producer and editor and screenwriter, but it kind of took on a larger than normal role insofar that they were just shooting what was happening to them.
Right.
And it was really up to her to make a story out of it that could be told in a, you know, in a contained amount of time. Right?
Yeah. And I think that's why she got a writing credit, because it was still going on, right? As she was, it wasn't like she, you know, it's a documentary, so she's not writing anything in that way, but she was involved in kind of the creative process as the, you know, the filming and shooting was going on. So yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to hear from her as playing such a big role, but at the same time, not really being on set or, you know, with the family. A few times, I think she met up with them on their journey, but kind of doing this from afar.
And they just kept filming and filming and filming.
That's right.
Right. Providing more footage than she knew what to do with in a lot of ways.
Yeah. But really interesting documentary. And, you know, something that she said was interesting in her talk about the way that she was trying to portray refugees. And it kind of went back to a moment in the film where I think the oldest daughter, they're in a camp somewhere. I can't remember where it was, but the oldest daughter's crying and the mom, the mother is asking her why. And she says, "I'm so bored." And, you know, you're not really expecting to hear her being bored. And, you know, your idea of a refugee is you can't be bored. You know, you're fleeing for your life and that's how you should be portrayed. And I think this is kind of what Emily was talking about, that she wanted to portray refugees, not in a way that we have this view of refugees that we have, which is they're, you know, they're kind of fleeing their life and they're always in danger and peril, but really kind of the larger struggles of being a refugee, which are not really having a purpose, right? Not really having meaning, not really having a foundation for your life, I think was really a struggle that she brought out through their story.
One thing that struck me is how differently they were received in each country, right? And that each country had its own particular challenges associated with being there and how difficult it was. I mean, the most horrific was the closer they got to Europe.
Right.
And that they met racism. And I mean, in Hungary, they're put in this really austere refugee camp with barbed wire around it. And
right.
I mean, they're the way that they're treated, and you get this too. I guess one thing that I'd never quite seen in this kind of way was, because you're focusing on a family, so you know, husband, a mother, and then two children, there you get more about that experience of the children, right? The perspective of the children, the perspective of the wife, of the husband. And that, to me, gave a little bit more complete picture than some of the other representations that tend to assume a little bit of a European or American viewpoint looking on the situation.
Right.
That this really kind of turned that camera around. And that was really effective for me.
Right. Yeah, and it's empowering that they were the ones in some ways. And you can tell by the way that the mother and the father who are traveling, the subjects of the documentary, are filmmakers themselves. And you can in some ways tell they have a sense. I mean, if they're working with, you know, very basic technology, there's a sense, they have a sense of kind of the image. I think that's in some ways maybe why the film resonated with our students as well, is that oftentimes in film we have there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about how film works, and you know, I mean, we have a million people on set, and what do they all do, and you know, how does the technology work, and I think it was stripped down to something that's so basic, you know, about making films,
right,
the way that we make films, that was really relatable, right? That they're making films on their phone, which is something that everyone has done. So,
well, and again, I think it speaks to Medavian's great contribution, her and her team, the way that they then matched in post-production sound, kind of a soundscape and music that wouldn't detract from that aesthetic,
right,
but nor make that aesthetic distracting, right, which it easily can be. If you see something that's just shot on cell phones, it's really easy to be bothered by that. But I wasn't bothered by that. It gave me a kind of it was supported in the right way by this other post-production that created a really nice effect of immediacy without being amateurish.
Right. Yeah.
Well, this is one, you know, definitely for anyone interested in the refugee crisis right now and these experiences, that one that needs to be, I think, high on their list. Next, let's turn our attention to the other films for the week. And to do this, we asked Rob McFarland, who's a professor in German and Russian, to come and talk to us. To help us now talk about the three films that we're all dealing with, the coming down of the Berlin Wall, we have with us Professor Rob McFarland, who's no stranger to IC audiences. He teaches in the Department of German and Russian. He's an affiliate faculty with both Global Women's Studies and International Cinema Studies. He's a regular lecturer at International Cinema, and every fall he teaches the German 217 class, which is German and Scandinavian Cinema. This next semester, he'll be teaching a special course listed both under International Cinema Studies and Global Women's Studies called The Gendered Camera, Women and Cinema. Welcome to From the Booth, Rob.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Rob, this week we had three films that were all about coming down to the Berlin Wall, or the reunification of Germany in one way or another, Balloon, and then Goodbye Lenin, which are maybe a little bit more related. Wings of Desire is a little bit different, so maybe we'll come to that one last. Get us started with Balloon and Goodbye Lenin. What do we need to know about these films?
Well, it is inconceivable to us today to imagine a border between two parts of a country that is not crossable, but between East Germany and West Germany. From 1961 until 1989, there was a hard border that they could not cross. There were guards that had the orders to shoot. And unless you had a pass to go from the west to the east or the east to the west, there was no crossing at all. And this family, who we get to know in the story of Balloon, this is a true story of a family who really thought that their options were very limited in the east and needed to get to the west. And the only way to do it was to try to build a balloon. If we think about the courage and how desperate do you really have to be to put your family in that kind of danger?
Yeah, a homemade balloon.
Exactly. And I think in a lot of ways, of course, this movie or this story has been told in film before in 1982 in the film Night Crossing with John Hurt and Beau Bridges. It was a Disney film and a really effective one. I remember going and seeing this in the theaters as a child.
Yeah, I remember that too.
Really amazed. And it was a different film in 1982, not only because of the technological differences, but it's a different film being filmed right now than it was in 1982. In 1982, we were right in the middle of the Cold War. We had no idea that in 1989 it was end. So it was about the story that it was about. It was about East Germans and West Germans and how terrible this wall was between it.
So how do you see this newer version as changing? I mean, the facts of the story, of course, haven't really changed. How does the interpretation change to, you know, why tell this in 2018? I mean, maybe obviously because we're approaching this big commemoration, but how is it inflected differently because of how we talk about this differently?
Well, as the cultural critic from the 1930s, Walter Benjamin, who himself lived in Berlin, used to say, history is always filled with the here and now, what he calls the Jetztzeit. And so they are remaking this in terms of the wall coming down and the 100th anniversary of the wall, I mean, the 30th anniversary of the wall in 1989. But in 2015, Germany was overwhelmed by a lot of people who, just like the family in Night Crossing, had to leave their homes and what they felt comfortable with doing and take their lives and the lives of their children into peril and had to make a crossing that was harrowing and a lot of people lost their lives and landed in Germany and had to start a new life. That's, of course, the refugee crisis, and these were Syrians. But you cannot watch the balloon without understanding the rafts that came across the Mediterranean.
Right.
I thought that was something that was really, really moving to me, is that we got a story that's a German story, but it's no longer just a German story. It's a story that ends in Germany in the same way that the first one ended from East to West Germany. But it's also the story of so many people and why people would come to the decision to leave the place where they are, where they're in danger. How much danger do you really have to be in to put yourself in physical danger?
Well, especially because they had two failed crossings or something like that. So they kind of knew what they were up against, and they persisted in a lot of ways. I mean, one thing that strikes me about this film too is that the way that the East Germans are represented, that is the authorities are represented, is about as friendly as you could, with still recognizing that it's a totalitarian regime that's restricting the freedom of its people. And I wondered if that reflects the fact that Germany is reunited now, and those divisions between East and West, of course, still persist. And there's, you know, been interesting articles in recent days, you know, talking about how unified is actually Germany. But these are our neighbors and fellow countrymen now. And so making the film in 2018, you have to take that into account. You can't villainize the East in quite the same way, right?
No, and there's also, this is a good segue into our next film, but there's also a certain feeling of what they call nostalgie. Nostalgia, I guess, is the way you would translate that. The idea that this right. Eastern Germany was so overwhelmingly lost in a few weeks. The brand names, the things that were familiar, the rhythm of life, their great free childcare, all of these things were lost in a narrative that vilified the entire place and said there was nothing worth keeping, which is really not true. I mean, there were horrible crimes perpetrated against these people. From the people shot at the border to, you know, the cells where they would drag people, leave some sort of radioactive element in there, and so that they would give cancer to their people that they wanted to have disappear. Really horrible things. And so we can't paint over that too lightly. But on the other hand, an entire way of life was lost, and there are parts of that that we really would benefit from. If we thought about women in the workforce and their capacity to have their children looked after at safe and clean, good, high-quality daycare. These are things that we can't overlook, and it's really important. I think somebody doing this now is filming for Germans, and understanding to poke at that divide is a little bit of a problem.
Well, and they do it through comedy, which is so effective too, right? That you find yourself laughing at yourself, but it's a critique at the same time. Like you're saying, it invites the basic storyline, you know, that whole regime has to be recreated, kind of reinvented, you know, to save the mother from getting a shock who's been in a coma during the coming down of the wall. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. But it also, I think, does a really good job saying, okay, yeah, why do we automatically assume that Coca-Cola and Mickey Mouse are better than some of these other things? I mean, the violence aside, that, you know, not all of it was part of that violence and complicit.
No, absolutely. And Goodbye Lenin, the beauty of this film, of course, is the relationship between the main character played by Daniel Brühl and his mother. This is the most important thing. The wide sweeping scope of history passes them by and impoverishes them and causes them all sorts of problems. But he has an imperative that is much more important than history, and that is to keep his mother alive. And part of keeping her alive is keeping this old world alive so that she doesn't suffer from the shock. And it would have been a different film if it would have been any other reason, if it would have just been nostalgia or some political commentary. But instead, this is based in a really human story between the two of them. And this is all done out of his love and concern for her. to a certain extent. At the same time, it's a wonderful vehicle to understand really how quickly and how irredeemably everything was lost. Even, you know, the part where he finds the old apartment that has all of the old brand names on the boxes and bottles is such a breakthrough, because materially their lives change so much from one week to the next. And what was available, where you shop. I was there in Berlin in 1990 on the day that the two currencies were unified. And the wall had been down for a couple of months, but it was fascinating. As I was there in the first part of my stay, I was working in West Berlin. You could easily tell East Germans by their clothing and especially by their haircuts. They just looked differently. And it was not 2 or 3 weeks later that I could not tell anymore who was from East Germany and who was from West Germany. The East Germans abandoned their way of doing things so fully and so with such vehemence took on themselves the new clothing, the new haircuts, so that they could pass as West German if they had to, which, and to, you know, to use the word pass like we do with race or like we do with gender is showing how fraught everything was at this point.
Well, there's a real danger, I guess, too, this astrology that you reference. I mean, you hear, you know, insofar that it's appealing to people today, to simply go back to a time when there was order and there was, you know, there were, you know, clear-cut morals, clear-cut good and bad, right? That sometimes this begins to sound a lot like an embrace of a totalitarian past that, you know, that Germany's kind of suffered from in multiple waves, right?
Right. Which is one of the interesting things about Goodbye Lenin, because again, it's kept on the personal. They're not making a comment about this other than to say, you know, she was a committed communist and there were good things about this, but it's couched in the language of love. And I love the scene when we don't even get to really hear it and understand what's going on because it's overshadowed by the whatever's going on. But the scene where the main character's girlfriend is talking to his mother and telling her, yes, the wall came down all this, and he's been doing this all for you. And she has to, you know, pretend like it's okay and pretend for him so that they're doing it for each other before the dramatic end of the film. But I think it's very interesting that it wasn't the politics. It wasn't all of these things. It's done down to the safe family level, which is an interesting choice. It's a good choice and a bad choice in a lot of ways. But there's things to be said about the politics.
Yeah, that's good. Well, talk to us a little bit about Wings of Desire. This is, I know, is one of your favorite films, one of my favorite films, I think, of the 20th century. It, you know, this is a real high point. Obviously, it has a connection to the Berlin Wall. That's why we chose it to be part of the series. But we had the great fortune as well that the person who wrote the screenplay, or one of the people who wrote the screenplay, Peter Handke, was the winner of the Nobel Prize this year in literature.
The great fortune and the great misfortune. There has never in the history of the Nobel Prize been a more controversial award given. Than Peter Handke, who is accused of being an apologist for Serbian war crimes. He spoke at the funeral of Slobodan Milosevic, who was the Serbian leader who carried out some of these war crimes. If you pay careful attention, Peter Handke, his publishers and others, scholars who were very interested in, including Scott Abbott, who earlier taught at BYU, now is at U of U, go out there and show that is not his project, save the Serbs from history. What he was interested in doing during the war was showing how vilifying one side is never productive. And he went to the Serbian side to show that they are humans and to humanize this Serbian side. And people didn't want humanized Serbs at that point. They wanted them to be vilified and say, evil is found on that side of our war. That's why we're bombing them. And he instead wanted to humanize everything. You see that in this film that he collaborated on the script with Wim Wenders. I talked about this with our 217 class this afternoon. Have you ever seen a place where, you know, angels are looking at humans in here? We can think about Good Omens. We can think about The Good Place now on television. Where do humans come off this beautifully? The angels love the humans. Not only Damiel, the main character played by Bruno Ganz, who falls in love with the trapeze artist, but everywhere you see here, the angels are concerned about humankind and feel and are very empathetic with the plight of humankind. It's a very humanistic view of humans from non-humans, from this raised viewpoint of the angels.
So, Rob, tell me what makes this movie so hard to understand, and what are strategies for getting at it?
This is a new cinematic language that he's using here. We see the world through the eyes of these angels, not only in terms of how the story is told, but in terms of the cinematography. So often we have this kind of angel cam that follows along. We see what they're seeing. And it takes us a while to figure out that they are listening to or sensing the thoughts of the humans around them. And that is the whole point. As they sit at the beginning in that BMW in the car dealership, and they're comparing their notes that they found from each of their travels around Berlin that day, they notice strange little things like a man going out into the rain and putting down his umbrella and feeling the rain himself. Another one is a little boy listening to somebody talk about tell the story of the Odyssey and stopping and not blinking while the other person is telling the story. And these are moments that we as an audience are saying, well, why are these things important? That's not moving a plot thing forward. These are random little things that people see as they these angels are picking up on. Why are these important instead of other things? Why do we have to know people's thoughts? And why is this so earth-shattering? We want, you know, news and crawl and things that we're used to. And the fascinating thing is these angels, for some reason, have a different notion of what's beautiful and important. And they are showing us the city through little moments of grace, little moments of beauty, little moments of humanity that are going on all around them that they are fascinated with. And so it's not only the human moments and the things that are different about them, it's places themselves. I'm really interested in the scene where the motorcyclist has an accident and is sitting there dying, and Damiel comes and places his hands on his head for a blessing. And doesn't invoke any authority or any power. Instead, he says, Tierra del Fuego and the Mississippi Delta and the old buildings of Charlottenburg, a place, a part of Berlin, and the gardens of Tivoli. And he talks about these places and these beautiful little spots that have no connection to each other as far as we're concerned, but it heals the man. And he starts saying these things as well until another human is able to come and take care of him. So Damiel keeps them alive by these little interconnected moments of grace that only the angels understand why they're like that.
Well, one of the things I really like about this dimension of the film is, you know, the angels are outside of time, right? That they're not bound by the same kind of rules of linear time. And so everything is present for them. And this is juxtaposed by the humans that are the exact opposite, right? That we're bound in time and we're limited in terms of what we can see. And there are certainly advantages to what the angels perceive and how they perceive it. But so too, this is really emphasized in the film, that the angels long to have that experience of being in time, of feeling and experiencing. And it's because of our mortality, right, that we're able to really to appreciate these things. We're too busy to appreciate them. Sometimes we're kind of moving through these spaces so quickly that we don't slow down and stop and look as if we were children again.
Isn't it interesting that they film the things that the angels see in black and white? And it's only when Damiel falls and becomes a human that he can see in color. And one of the very last things that he says is, "Now I know what no angel
That's
knows."
Right.
And the idea that there are things that humans can know, things that we experience with our bodies here on Earth, that an angel has no connection to. And so it's a beautiful idea that the human experience isn't something evil and fallen and worthless, but that even angels could wish to be and experience the things that we see.
Well, and that it comes precisely because of our boundedness, right? Which I think that's why the wall is such a wonderful metaphor in this movie, that they're using it in that kind of way, that it's, you know, we think about limitations as something that are maybe bad and that they hold us back, that they limit us. And certainly the Berlin Wall acted that way for many people. But at the same time, it's precisely our limitations, the way that we're bounded, that makes experience possible, right?
That's interesting, with death and the wall being there. And also because when Damiel falls from being an angel to being a human, it happens in the no man's land, figuratively and literally, between the two walls, where the earth is raked so that the guards could see if anybody had been climbing over. And that, in this raked earth, is where we see his footprints start to have weight in the human dimension.
Right.
And he falls in this no man's land, in this place between the walls. And that's the place that he becomes human, is right on this limit, in this very liminal space.
That's so beautifully done. Well, I mean, this film is one that will, you know, it's been at IC before. It will be back at IC again. It, like I said, it really is one of the gems of the 20th century, I think. And so well done. So, I mean, it's philosophy, it's poetry and film, I think, in a lot of ways.
That is one of the arguments I'd make about the film, is how to read it and how to see it. Is, you know, if you read a novel, there's one certain way you have to read it. And that is, you know, you got to get from here and then this happens and then this and then this, and then that you're at the end. Whereas if you read poetry, you do it differently. There are different little chunks that mean something that don't have anything to do with each other. And you strip them down of everything else and place them next to each other in a way that doesn't make chronological sense. It doesn't necessarily move us from place to place. They're glowing little jewels of their own, which set next to each other really enhance each other and make something beautiful. And that is what this film is. It's poetry, not prose.
That's exactly. And that's, of course, how it's bookended too, right? That we see and we hear Damiel's voice and we see the poetry, you know, being written. Well, Rob, thank you so much for being with us today and talking us through some of these films.
Thank you very much for calling all the way from Paris to keep this going.
Well, let's turn our attention now to the films for the coming week. That is 13th to 16th of November. All the films this week are linked by the theme of representing race, and the documentary that we have this week on Toni Morrison kind of helps to frame this. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it, Mark?
Yeah, this is a documentary from 2019, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, that played at Sundance by Timothy Greenfield Sanders. And it's a really great tribute to her, made before she actually passed away.
Yeah, this is really timely, right? It's she just died August 5th of this year, when our schedule was already set.
Right, yeah. So a very timely documentary, and really a great way of looking at her life as a writer, editor. She taught college courses. She was a Nobel Prize winner, really accomplished in that way. And really, in some ways, I didn't even realize all the things that her work as an editor as well was kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, that's really important for encouraging others, right?
It is, right? Yeah, that her role is not just a writer herself, but in fostering and developing other writers was something that was very meaningful. Something that I think is maybe most valuable when we think about the way in which this film will frame our viewing of the other films we're watching this week, Green Book and If Beale Street Could Talk in particular, is something that she says about the idea of the white gaze, which is the way in which literature, media, film can often present a certain worldview that maybe a biased worldview that we don't always detect as we're watching media, that there's a certain way in which characters are portrayed that might not necessarily go along with experiences of minority characters themselves. And so it's an interesting question to think about, and something that I think is interesting, especially in terms of film, because film is really about framing experience and characters and their lives and the kind of ideological implications that go along with the way in which we do frame them. And I think this is something that we can think about in terms of Green Book and Beale Street in particular. I think, as we mentioned when we were introducing the semester, we talked about this idea of, you know, how do you capture Black characters? How does Hollywood attempt to, in some ways, maybe honor Black characters or kind of undo some of the injustices that have been done, or, you know, how do you depict their lives? And I think in some ways what Hollywood has done for the most part is to try to put Black characters, minorities on a pedestal, make them kind of honor them in a way that is almost in a way dehumanizing, because we don't really get to see the real struggles. They're not really kind of these round characters. They tend to be a little bit more flat, a little bit more unexamined in the story. And I think that's a good question to think about in terms of Green Book and Beale Street. Are we seeing these characters through that traditional way of viewing Black characters, or are we seeing something different?
Yeah, and this was one of the controversies, right? Is these two films were pitted against each other for Best Picture this last
right.
year. And there's been so much controversy about the representation of Blackness in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And then Green Book winning out over Beale Street was seen by some as a little bit of an affront, insofar that Green Book is a good example of white people looking at some of these issues, particularly, you know, with Black people. Whereas Beale Street, you know, written by James Baldwin,
right.
directed by Barry Jenkins, you know, an all African-American cast that, you know, in some ways deals a little bit more sensitively with these very issues that you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a question to think about as in Green Book in particular, which is this really interesting story. I mean, it's a really great story about Don Shirley, who's a jazz pianist, and his friendship with a valet slash bodyguard who goes by the name of Anthony Lipp, who's a minor actor, I think, in Hollywood and has kind of lived a very interesting life. But Anthony Lipp was Don Shirley's driver on trips through the South when Don was performing at various locations. And maybe something kind of interesting about the story is that apparently Anthony Lipp did not give permission for the story to be told until he said that story couldn't be told until he was no longer living. And so I think after he died in 2013, I think. And so that was when the film was planned and production was kind of greenlit. But it maybe more than their story is really the interesting story about the Negro Motorist Green Book, which was an actual kind of guidebook, travel book that listed businesses that were friendly to African-Americans in the segregated South at this time. And it was used by people who were traveling there. And so really interesting part of history that the film is dealing with through. And, you know, you can argue that maybe it's a little romanticized. And that's something that maybe we can think about as we watch this film is the film presenting these characters in a way that is making us feel more comfortable? Is it trying to kind of to fix some of these injustices? Or is it showing them with more depth, more character development, more humanity? I don't know if the answer is really that simple. I think this is a film that could go either way, or that interpretations could go either way. And so that's always something to think about as you're watching this film is does it present things from maybe a white gaze, or is there a different perspective that's coming out?
Well, I think it'll be a nice contrast to If Beale Street Could Talk, which is based, as I mentioned, on a James Baldwin novel. The James Baldwin estate has been really reluctant to allow his work to be adapted for the screen. So there's not a lot of these adaptations. You know, Barry Jenkins he's, of course, the director for Moonlight that won the Academy Award, what was it, a year or two ago?
Yeah.
And it kind of earned the trust, you know, on the part of the estate, you know, to do it. James Baldwin's niece, I found this interesting quote about this film and about the novel generally. She quite liked the adaptation, and her take on it was that this film, which is about this couple, young couple, kind of falling in love, trying to start their life together with all the regular pressures of doing that. And then on top of that, being Black in New York at this, you know, in the early 70s, all the pressures that, you know, that go with that on top of it. And what she said about it was, quote, "The act of loving while Black is a revolutionary act. It is an act of resistance to love under the conditions with which we live, to raise children, to maintain family, and just continue the resistance and stay strong." Close quote. And what really came out to me in this film is that there is a struggle when you're marked by your society as being some kind of outsider, not being perceived as being mainstream in whatever way, that is a real burden to do the things that are already very difficult. And I think this film really shows it well. I really like Barry Jenkins' style. Very expressionistic in his aesthetics, really lush colors.
Yeah.
It's slow, you know, kind of camera work. There's not a lot of quick edits. He loves these shots where we get this long look at the characters who are looking straight into the camera. Sometimes speaking into the camera. And this direct address, I think, is maybe a way of dealing with what you're talking about, right? That we're used to seeing this white gaze where it's being imposed upon, you know, these characters. They're really being given this chance to meet our, you know, our vision in this case.
Yeah.
And it creates this wonderful empathy, I think, for the characters and their situations. It's not cheap tricks. It's about, you know, family life. And it's not a linear structure either. We're kind of jumping forward and backward in time, which I think helps to focus us on the overall emotion of it and the experience of, you know, of what that's like. So these are some things to kind of look for when you're watching that film.
Yeah, I like how it, in some ways the story is maybe a familiar story about African-Americans and family and prison are kind of elements that are often stereotypically, right, applied to the Black experience. And in some ways those elements are still there, but it's the way that maybe they are depicted or the characters react to them, that it's very different, right, than you usually are used to seeing.
Yeah, that's right. To complement this, we have a fourth film this week, Girlhood by Celine Sciamma. It's a French film from 2014. It's been at International Cinema before. It's one of the great international films from the teens, I think. And it's a complement to these other films in that we're not dealing with African Americans, we're dealing with African Europeans in this in this case. So the original title is Bande de Filles, which is perhaps a riff on Godard's Bande à Part. And this is this idea of a kind of a gang of girls that find themselves as outsiders. They're all, we're to understand in the film, immigrant children. So their parents come from other places and they have grown up in the banlieue of Paris. So these are the what we might translate as suburbs, but suburbs in Europe function differently than suburbs in the United States. This is the outside, the marginalized places. And right. The city itself is an important character, I think, in this film. The film is a lot about territory, where you are in the city and how the city constructs you or kind of includes you or excludes you in different kinds of ways. And so this is something I definitely think that audiences should look for, is how this teenager, we focus on one particularly, Mariam, who changes her name to Vic, and how she negotiates being this outsider within this society, a society that is her society, right? That she doesn't know any other society. She's grown up in it, but she's being excluded by certain things. There's others who are accepting her, but they're not the ones that are going to kind of help her to integrate or to be, you know, to be a part of society. And Sciamma as a filmmaker, I think, is great for doing the kinds of things we were talking about with Barry Jenkins too, where she was she herself is a white, you know, French woman, and was very sensitive to not wanting to impose this story on an experience that she hadn't been part of herself. And in fact, I have a quote from her. She says, "I didn't feel I was making a film about Black women, but with Black women. It's not the same. I'm not saying I'm going to tell you what it's like to be Black in France today. I just want to give a face to the French youth I'm looking at." She worked very closely with these actresses that make up this group of girls that they're following. They had a lot of input kind of on how things were portrayed. And you know, again, I don't know that it's about kind of a documentary look about what it's like being Black in France. It definitely raises some interesting questions about what does privilege mean, and how does a society spatially or otherwise privilege certain and not privilege others. Our viewers should watch for how the character looks, that is how it is portrayed as looking, and how we look at her and how she looks back at us. These are all really important things that are going on in the film. And then the use of the frame, that Sciamma makes really interesting use of the frame, what's in the frame and what's not in the frame, how the frame captures the characters at certain moments and at other moments when it doesn't. And you know, we can talk a little bit more about this next week, but these are some things definitely to watch for.
Yeah, very nice.
Well, thank you for joining us on From the Booth today. Our podcast is produced by the International Cinema Program at BYU and supported by the BYU College of Humanities. The hosts and guests of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they don't necessarily represent any official position adopted by the university or its supporting institutions. As always, we thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center and Humanities College web team for their help and support. Until next week, we hope to find you in 250 the Kimball Tower. Thanks, Mark.
See you next time.